Thank you, Brittany. Thanks, everybody, for being here. And when you know you're the last guy in the program, you don't know if you're going to have anybody in the audience to talk to. So it's good to see that there's still a few people hanging on. This morning, I'm going to talk about a couple different projects that I've been working on. I'm going to end up with the bollworms, and that's the most relevant based on all the things that we've been talking about today. Before that, I'm going to briefly go through some work I've been doing assaying soybean loopers and tarnished plant bugs. So, soybean looper, I've been screening. I just started in 2018, screening for resistance to spinosad, to methoxyphenazide, and chlorantraniliprole, or Prevathon. Tarnished plant bug, part of Beverly Katchut's master's work, screening for resistance to Centric, Admire, Pro, and Transform. And then I'm going to talk about work I'm doing with Prevathon. So I don't have a slide talking about the methods for all of these. For the soybean looper, we're doing a diet incorporation assay, and we're doing the full range assays. And the times that we're looking at, it varies with the product we're looking at. Tarnished plant bug, we're using a floral foam feeding assay for the two neonics and a rolled vial for the transform. And then I'll talk about the Prevathon later. So I'm going to get right into the results. For soybean looper, looking first at the Blackhawk resistance. So this is all 2018 data. We were able to collect four colonies before the soybean looper populations crashed on us. So we got one from Mississippi, one from South Carolina, one from Virginia, one from North Carolina. Unfortunately, the North Carolina was a small collection and it survived, but when we ran the assays, we never got good fits on it on any of our insecticides. So I'm not going to present any North Carolina data because none of it fit well. So we ran assays on first F1 generation, and then we kept it and confirmed it with the F2. As you can see here, very similar results both generations. So the susceptibilities was very stable, at least through the two generations. And if you focus on, I have a lab colony of soybean looper that is our baseline, and you can see resistance ratios based on LC50s, resistance ratios on the far right based on LC90s, and you can see that everything is less than two. So we had zero evidence of any resistance of soybean looper to spinosad in this current year. And all of them were, you know, pretty similar. If we look at methoxyphenazide, a little more variable, but again, the very highest resistance ratio we generated was the LC50 for Virginia in the F2 generation, and it wasn't there in the F1 generation. And it's only five. So we've heard plenty of people talking using a base of resistance ratio of 10 to start getting concerned. So I'm not concerned, and there's not really any evidence of any change over the last several years. We did these assays on methoxyphenicide back in 2010 and 11. Lucas Owen did that as part of his PhD work. And you can see that the ratios that we generated back then were comparable to the ratios we've generated now. So it doesn't look like there's been any change over the last 8 years or so in Intrepid. So no issues of any concern there. Prevathon, which is the one that receives probably the most pressure. And you can see that most of our resistance ratios were less than one. So our lab colony actually is less susceptible than our field colonies that we collected. So no evidence for any issues with Prevathon and soybean looper in 2018. I've talked with some other colleagues that have done some similar monitoring this year, and they've likewise found similar results. Now, if you know, as you know, soybean looper is not overwintering in most of the United States. So what we get next year isn't necessarily going to mirror what we've seen in 2018. But 2018, we likewise didn't have really issues with soybean looper, mainly not because of resistance susceptibility, but because that the environment, the fungus, virus, took them out without our intervention. So 2018 was a light year for soybean looper. Tarnished plant bug, I've summarized it all in one slide. And partially I'm going over it quickly because I'm not quite sure how to interpret what we're finding. So we've done a bunch of screening with Admire, Centric, and Transform. And all of this was done from within Mississippi. So we broke our region into two regions, Delta region, which is the Mississippi River Delta, which is the intensive agricultural production area where we have significant problems with tarnished plant bug, and then the hills, which also grows a fair amount of cotton, but tends to have a lot lighter tarnished plant bug pressure, has a lot more alternative habitats, weedy habitats where the tarnished plant bugs are found. And in past research, we've found differences between these populations. So I broke them out and then I combined them both. So you can see we've looked at approximately 20 populations in these 10 in each of the regions. And we get a lot of variability. So resistance. Now, one of the problems I have in tarnished plant bugs is rather than rearing a colony for doing these assays where you get F1s and F2s, we collect and we immediately assay the adults that we've collected in the field. So it's the parental population we're screening. So they're pulled directly from the field. We have a lab colony. Our lab colony is fat and happy and tends to be much less resistant. Much less susceptible to these insecticides. So I don't feel like it's a very fair baseline to use. So what I did, and I've not seen this done in the literature, and it probably will never get published that way, but I took I had 10 populations. I took the 6 lowest LC50 estimates and said, okay, that's susceptible populations, averaged those 6, and then said, okay, that's what I'm going to base my resistance ratio on. You can like it or not, that's what these numbers are generated on, because I didn't know what else to do. And based on that, so that's where the resistance ratio comes from, just to give you an idea of how variable they are. If you look at the Centric in the Delta, my lowest one in the Delta was just over 1. My highest one is 188 times higher than that. So extreme variability. If you look at Centric overall, I had some populations that were very, very sensitive to Centric and some very, very resistant. I mean, the difference between the highest and lowest, 0.06 to 188. So that's whatever, a couple thousand times difference in LC50s in an assay done in the same lab during the same year. So very, very variable responses. The other pesticides not quite as variable as the Centric was. So resistance, I just said I used the 10X, and I based on my definition of what the baseline was, how many of those populations were actually 10 times higher than that. And you can see that Admire, we didn't have very many populations higher than more than 10 times my baseline, but Centric and Transform both, we're in the 30% range for resistance. So there's a lot, the take home for me out of this is we have a very variable response of insecticides to these chemistries, especially to Centric and somewhat to Transform as well. So it shouldn't be surprising that sometimes we get a lot better control than other times when we're spraying these populations. So I think I've already said some. The loopers had a light year. Nothing showed up any resistant at all. Plant bugs, likelihood of encountering resistance, i.e. not being able to control. I think Centric is the most likely to have problems. Transform next, and Admire had the least amount of variability. And I didn't really bring it out, but the Centric, we had higher resistance levels in the Delta than in the Hills, but it was very variable in both regions. Okay, the rest of the time I have here, I'm going to talk about bollworm on Prevathon. I've started over the last 2 years to try to find a quick method to assay bollworms. We've heard so many talks this the last couple days about we have two chemistries working on bollworms. We have VIP, COT, and we have diamides. And if we lose either one of those, we're in a world of hurt. So I wanted to develop a quick screening method that we could use for screening susceptibility to Prevathon. And what I started out doing is basically trying to mimic the pyrethroid rolled vial assay that we have used for decades as a way that we could do this. So knowing that Prevathon also is ingested, but if we could find something we could do on the moth that we could find out very quickly what is a potential problem. So I wanted to evaluate how durable rolled vials are. We needed to find a discriminating concentration that we can use. And then I wanted to evaluate the impact of heat, light, and then the last thing, which is still left to be done, is to estimate how adult moth susceptibility relates to larval susceptibility. So first of all, looked at durability. And these are from field population collected. So the red line is fresh vials prepared the day of the assay. The blue line is aged. They were all prepared at the same time, and then we kept them under lab conditions in the dark for up to 90 days. And you can see that initially we had a drop, and most of that drop was actually within the first 24 to 48 hours, but then it remained quite stable after that. So it appears that we get more mortality if we're really fresh vials, but once they're about 48 hours old, it is pretty constant from then on. So it does appear that we can prepare them and ship them out ahead of time. The next trial I did was looking at the impact of temperature and UV light on these vials. So there's a lot of numbers on this slide, but I kept the vials either in a freezer, kept them at room temperature, or I kept them in a growth chamber at 40 degrees C, which is a little over 100. So that'd be the worst case scenario of being shipped and sitting on a dock somewhere. And I'd have it short term, which was 24 hours, and long term, which was 2 weeks. And then I'd run the assay, or run the moths through this. This was using a lab colony, so that all of these were done with the same colony of insects. And as you look at this, you can see there's no, other than the acetone control, which of course didn't have insecticide in it, there's no significant differences. We're running 80 to 90% on every condition. So it doesn't appear that temperature or UV light had any impact on the durability of these vials. So that's a good thing. We don't have to worry. We don't have to store them under any special conditions. The last thing in my last 30 seconds here is looking at field susceptibility. And this is the more concerning, and I don't quite know how to interpret yet. So my lab survival was running around 15%, so that's the black line. And then I have field collections from pheromone traps that I ran, that Gus Lorenz ran in Arkansas, and Jeremy Green ran in South Carolina. And I prepared all the vials and shipped them, and they ran them when they had moths. You can see in Mississippi, we ranged from 20 to 30%. So what I was shooting for is a discriminating dose that would give me a susceptible population should have 10 to 20% survival. And if it's significantly more survival than that, I would consider that resistant. You can see in Mississippi, we were always pretty much in that ballpark. But in South Carolina in 18, other than July, we were in that range. But we have both in Arkansas in 18 and in South Carolina in 17, we had populations that over several weeks, both of these are summarized by months, but we have multiple assays within those months. They were up there getting 60, 70% survival. Is that resistance or is it something else? I don't feel like we know yet, but it's definitely concerning if we're seeing some of these outbreaks of resistance already in Prevathon. I was not able to collect larval populations from these locations, so I don't have anything to compare these to and to know. We're hopefully going to get better in that in 2019. So I believe the rolled vial assay does appear like a viable method. Discriminating dose of 10 micrograms per vial is what I've used. It kills 80 to 90% of my lab colony, and most of the time we were getting 60 to 90% of field populations, but we had those two cases out of six, so that's sort of too frequent, where we had lower than 40, 50% mortality. So maybe I need to go to a higher concentration and get rid of some of those maybe false positives that are in there, or maybe we are already having pop-ups of resistance. I do not know that. So this is a research in progress. It's not a final product. I do hope that this coming year to engage more of you in this effort so we get more locations and we can get a better feel for whether those are outliers or whether this is an ongoing problem. And I would just like to thank the IRAC U.S. Committee for funding, Syngenta for funding, Cotton Incorporated for funding various parts of the research I shared today, and all the people that actually did the work in rearing all these insects and doing all those assays. And I know I've already run over time, but I know there's nobody else waiting. So if you have a question, go ahead. Dominic.
Yes, so when you showed the tartar lab, you said you used two different methods, right? You had the vial, and then you had like a
feeding. For the two neonics, it's a fluorofoam feeding assay. For the spinosad, it's a rolled vial.
Sulfoxaflor.
I'm sorry. I said spinosad. I meant sulfoxaflor. We did. We did. We've done it both ways. They both work. If the rolled vial works, it's easier. Yeah. And well, that's what I don't really know. I basically have my lab colony, which gives me a point. So you can't run a regression with a single point, and that's my problem. Hopefully, David Kearns is going to do some work in the future where he has a lot of populations that might have varying levels of susceptibility, and we can develop that line. But I don't have that data yet. I'd like it, but I don't have it. Yes, sir.
If you're wild test, you develop into a wild test, you lose activity in the first 48 hours.
Yes.
Do you have a hypothesis that could there be odds?
So whether, you know, you're dissolving it in acetone, whether there's some residues of or interactions with the acetone that is gone within 24 to 48 hours, I don't know exactly, but I talked to somebody and they said, oh yeah, I've seen that on some other assay at some other time. So I don't have an answer, but I saw it pretty consistently, so I think it's real. Thank you very much.